Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Frances Fox Piven, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Political Science at the Graduate School, City University of New York. Frances is also the President of the American Sociological Association and is the author of numerous publications, most recently Keeping Down the Black Vote with Lorraine Minnight and Margaret Groke, published by the New Press in 2009. Frances Fox Piven is the recipient of many awards, including the Distinguished Career Award for the Practice of Sociology in 2002. She has said that her lifetime preoccupation has been with the uses of social science to promote democratic reform. Frances Piven joins us now on the phone. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Frances.
Well, I'm very glad for the chance to talk to you, Helen. You know, we haven't talked for decades.
No,
I think.
But we often appeared on the same platforms, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Well, a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, I've always admired you and your work, and I know you've been struggling against difficult odds. But suddenly, you've become notorious because the dreadful man Glenn Beck has attacked you and keeps on attacking you. The focus of his attack is a paper that you wrote with your husband, The Weight of the Poor, basically signing up poor people for welfare payments. Then the government would have to give them guaranteed income. And I know you've worked all your life, Frances, to help the poor. But tell us about what Beck's saying and your analysis of him.
Oh, okay. I'd love to. First, let me explain that Glenn Beck focuses on an article that Richard and I wrote 45 years ago. And he has also recently focused on a short article I wrote in The Nation. The in-between period, about 45 years, he says nothing about that.
Mm.
He says nothing about anything I've written in the interim. I'm sure he hasn't read it, but
no.
He probably hasn't read the things he does talk about either. So it's a sort of peculiar thing. He focuses on this little article in 1966 and this other article in 2011.
And what did the articles basically say?
Well, the first article was based on research that Richard and I had done, which showed that the welfare system, with the system of cash assistance for poor mothers and their children, was only reaching about one-third of the people who were eligible.
Mm.
The way the system worked was that it made it very hard for people to get the benefits. In this case, mothers and children, that's who we're talking about,
mm.
It made it very difficult for them to get the benefits that they were entitled to. It rebuffed them. It intimidated them. It made it too complicated. It humiliated them by asking questions about the sexual behavior of the mothers or by investigating them, knocking at the door in the middle of the night. There were a lot of features of this system that were designed to keep people away, to keep people from claiming the benefits to which they were entitled. So we proposed that social workers, lawyers, community organizers work with the poor themselves to claim these benefits. And then we extrapolated what we thought would be the political and financial consequences. We thought that this would raise costs in the cities, at a time when there was a lot of racial conflict in the cities, and that under those circumstances, a democratic national government would look for ways to cool things because the Democrats depended on urban support. And the one way to cool things, one way to keep things on an even keel was some kind of guaranteed income at the federal level. Now, you know, people talk about this as if it were a crazy idea, but in fact, Richard Nixon proposed a guaranteed income just a couple of years later to cope with rising welfare rolls and rising welfare costs that resulted from an emerging welfare rights movement with which we worked. Now, you know, sensible people, reasonable people, might say, well, this wasn't the right thing to do. You shouldn't get mothers and their children welfare assistance. You should get them jobs.
How do you get a job when you've got a couple of kids and they're little?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would say that, but that's not exactly the point. Not now, not 45 years later. The point really is that Glenn Beck calls this a blueprint for orchestrated crisis to bring down capitalism.
Oh, my God.
Wait a moment. He has a tree. He draws it on his chalkboard. At the trunk of the tree is Cloward and Piven. And then there are big branches that go off from the trunk to SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, to George Soros and the Open Society Institute, to the New York City fiscal crisis in 1976, to the recent financial meltdown, to the election of Barack Obama. All of this originates in this article which laid out a plan for trying to reform welfare. And so Glenn Beck has been propounding this theory for almost 2 years now. And then at the beginning of January, January 10th, I wrote an article in The Nation, which was mainly about the obstacles to organizing the unemployed in the United States, the problems that organizers have to overcome, problems such as the fact that the unemployed are dispersed, they're no longer gathered together at one workplace, they're also ashamed, generally, of the fact that they don't have a job. Mm. There isn't a natural local target for their action. Well, but then I said, we have to try to overcome these obstacles to organizing the unemployed because we need a movement of the unemployed. We need movements of the unemployed such as exist in other parts of the world. Because protest movements
like
make
Egypt,
a difference.
Like Egypt.
Like Egypt.
Yeah.
It could be Egypt.
Yep.
Or it could be the protests that are sweeping through England.
Yes.
The UK uncut protests. It could be Greece. I think I mentioned Greece.
Mm.
But that was treated by the right-wing blogs as another call for violent and bloody revolution. Now, they take pretty innocent words, or if not innocent words, at least words that are part of democratic discourse, susceptible to debate, to be sure, and they frame these words in what you might call they actually did frame some of my words in a burning American flag with my head in the middle of it.
Oh, my God!
And the consequence is that on their news sites or blogs, really, on the Internet, hundreds and hundreds of people post curses and death threats against me. And so this, in turn, I began to speak out about this, and I did this on television. I wrote a couple of articles, and other academic and liberal organizations began to rally to denounce Glenn Beck and Fox News and the Murdoch Empire for irresponsible programming, which encourages death threats. And we all know that in the United States, death threats have a certain traction.
Yep.
It's a country with a lot of violence.
And guns.
And guns. A lot of violence, you know, sort of a violent culture with a lot of guns. Yeah.
Yep.
So the upside is that, you know, 2 days ago, 23 academic associations released public statements that first said that I had, you know, I was very eminent. I had made a contribution, especially to welfare policy and to voting rights, and that this was unacceptable, that Glenn Beck was trying to prevent democratic discourse and academic discourse, that it was a process of intimidation, and that Fox News should take him off the air. Then at the same, about the same time, liberal organizations have been rallying as well. And I think this is very important because I think this is how fascist movements start. They start with the spinning of paranoid fantasies about, you know, people are anxious. There have been big changes that have overtaken your country, my country, other countries. Some of those changes have included deindustrialization and the financial collapse of the last few years. And so a lot of people are suffering economic hardship in the United States as a result of declining wages or joblessness or cutbacks in public social programs. But we know from survey data that the people who respond with sympathy for Tea Party or right-wing populist positions are not the people who are experiencing economic hardship. They do not report economic hardship.
Oh, really? That's very interesting, isn't it? Because as you talk, I think about the Weimar Republic in Germany and how so many people were, I mean, they were carting money round in wheelbarrows, and you know, the whole society had collapsed post First World War, which brought on the fascistic movement. And do you feel there are any, first of all, what is the rate of unemployment now, the true rate of unemployment in America? And number two, do you think there are any resonances with post World War One Germany?
Well, first, the rate of unemployment now, real unemployment, is probably about 15%.
I thought it was more like 20.
Well, you know, everybody makes their own calculations, guesses based on how many people are in part-time work or how many people are discouraged and have stopped looking for
That's
work.
That's right, who haven't registered.
Yeah. So we know that the unemployment rate among African Americans is much, much higher. At any rate, you know, there's a lot of unemployment, and it's horrific.
And homelessness.
And there's a lot of homelessness. A lot of people are losing their homes. They've been sort of suckered into mortgages that they cannot pay, subprime mortgages, with ballooning payments required as time goes on. So a lot of people are in homes that are either being foreclosed or that are what we call underwater, meaning that they owe more on the house than the house is now worth.
Terrible.
Because of the drop in housing prices.
Terrible.
So these people probably should walk away from their house.
Yeah.
And leave the bank with the deficit, whatever it is. But And we also know that hunger is increasing, and that extreme, not only is poverty, official poverty, and the official poverty line is set very low in the United States, but the numbers below that line are increasing, and the numbers that we call desperately poor, extreme poverty, those numbers are increasing even more rapidly. So there is a lot of hardship in the United States. But the Tea Party-style protests are not occurring among the most hard-hit parts of the population. The people who express in surveys sympathy for the Tea Party politics are older. They're almost all white.
Yeah.
And they are not as likely to report economic hardship. But nevertheless, and this was the point to which I wanted to come, I think these people also experience anxiety about changes that have overtaken the country. They're also anxious when their community changes because the only factory has closed, even though they were not factory workers. And they're anxious about changes that have taken place in our sexual and family mores, for example. They remember nostalgically a time when a man was a man and a woman was a woman, and everybody got married before they had a baby and got married in a church with a steeple and so forth and so on. And the changes of this sort do create generate a lot of anxiety, even though we are, you know, don't talk about those changes in that way. And then also, you know, the United States is becoming a country of immigrants. And not only are we becoming a country with a very diverse population, but we have an African-American president. We have a kind of political etiquette in this country that nobody says that's the problem.
No.
That that's what they're objecting to.
It is,
to.
But it is, isn't it, Francis?
But it is.
It's instead racism.
Instead they say, he's not really born in the United States.
Yeah.
Or he's really a Muslim.
Yeah.
But what I think really drives people, some people, berserk is that we have an African-American president and that in states like Arizona, in no time at all, they'll have a majority-minority population.
Of Hispanics.
Yes, yes.
I'm interviewing today Francis Fox Piven, who's a distinguished professor of sociology and political science at the Graduate School, City University of New York. So, Francis, also, you've got a black first lady and two black children in the White House. I mean, it's sticking out like the proverbial, to say the least, that, in fact, this is a latent or cryptogenic racism that's going on. Would you say?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I think that.
Why doesn't anyone spell it out?
They would deny it.
Who's they? Who's they?
The right would certainly deny it. Glenn Beck would deny that he is.
But he's a paranoid nut.
Yeah, I know. But he talks to, at its peak, he had almost 3.5 million listeners on TV. He has 3 hours a day on TV, 2 hours on radio. He has best-selling books. He has an internet blog. You know, this is a very important person if you want to understand the currents of popular politics in the United States and the extraordinary timidity of the political mainstream leaders.
What the hell are they up to? I mean, why are they so scared? That's what I can't understand. And also, you know, I think Obama's a highly intelligent, moral, scrupulous man, but he's been enveloped by the powers that be and the corporations and the Pentagon and the like. And yet he had the moral advantage of being elected by a large majority of people, and he could have really flown and been an inspirational leader. So what do you think has happened, Francis Fox Piven?
Well, I think he's I think his nature is to be cautious.
Yeah.
And he is a politician. And I don't say that as a criticism.
Yeah.
That means he's a cautious man. He carefully calculates the obstacles he'll have to overcome, the pressures that he'll experience, advantages he can gain. And he's been operating in an environment with a lot of what we call heavy hitters in the United States, a lot of fat cats in politics, a lot of big money contributors on the one hand, and he got a lot of money from Wall Street.
And from the nuclear industry, let me say.
I didn't know that. Oh, I'm glad to know that.
$250,000.
And he, at the same time, there are no movements yet. I think there will be. There have been, though, until now, no movements from his base.
Yeah.
His base has given him a free ride. And if we want Obama to become a leader, a good president, a president that moves the United States in a direction that is more democratic, then he needs to be pressed from the bottom by his base. And he needs to be pressed by protest movements.
The trouble is, though, is Frances Fox Piven, is social engineering. And the trouble is television. And the trouble is that when people watch television, and most people do for many hours a day, especially if they're unemployed and they're depressed and they're at home with their children and poor, the brain goes into alpha wave activity, which is sort of an anesthetized state where it accepts everything that is presented to it, and there's not enough time to analyze what is being said, and it also passes the neocortex into the midbrain, and people are being brainwashed, really. And so they haven't got any outstanding leaders to say, for Christ's sake, what's going on? Let's rise up. And also they're being preempted by this Glenn Beck character and my fellow countryman, Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I think that there is certainly a lot of truth to what you're saying, Helen. But look at the examples that we have in the world today of people who do suddenly break through the kind of fog that's created by television, heavy-handed propaganda, and I mean, look at Egypt.
Yes.
Look at the protests in England.
Or what about Tunisia, where that lovely college student set himself on fire? So he was selling vegetables, and he just couldn't stand it. The police cracked down any longer, and that was a spark, to use a bad pun, to spark a revolution in Tunisia, which has now spread to Egypt and elsewhere.
And to Bahrain.
Yep.
And
Yemen.
Perhaps Libya.
And Yemen.
So, but you know, just today, just yesterday and today in the United States, I've been hearing more and more reports of protests. For example, 15,000 students turned out in Wisconsin in a rally to protest the announcement by the new Republican Tea Party governor there, a guy named Scott Walker, made an announcement that he was determined to strip public sector workers of their right to collective bargaining. And in case they didn't like it, he was calling out the National Guard.
Oh.
Now, incredibly, over the weekend, 15,000 students organized to come to the state capitol. They had chants saying, what is their chant saying again? Well, I can't remember.
Oh,
what
a pity.
they had banners and posters and picket signs. It was a wonderful demonstration.
Yeah.
And it happened overnight.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Blogging, Facebook, Twitter, social networking.
Yeah, but so, I mean, you shouldn't be sure that people can be anesthetized
entirely
for such a long time. I think we may see a series of protest movements in the United States, maybe over foreclosures targeting the banks, maybe over student loans and the extorted repayments that the banks are asking.
Still, I thought they passed a law preventing that.
That's for the ones for new students. It doesn't cover the ones who are who are already indebted.
Oh.
And although I'm glad that you follow U.S. politics closely.
I read the New York Times and Washington Post every day, Frances.
Oh, good. Good.
And The Guardian. And if let me interrupt to say, if anyone hears some funny noise in the background, we're in a studio with a tin roof in a little fishing village in Bermagui, Australia, and it's raining cats and dogs, so there's a background sort of accompaniment to this, which is good because we've been in extreme drought and now we're having a lot of rain because of global warming. That's an aside. I'm interviewing Frances Fox Piven, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Political Science at the Graduate School, City University of New York. So would you think, Frances, that the movement could be led with these students? Because often revolutions are led by students, aren't they?
Yes.
The young ones who have no fear. And you know that the Facebook social networking that was begun at Harvard so a guy could, you know, be interested in more women now may help to mobilize the United States of America.
I think it could happen. I hope it will happen. I see some signs. You know, maybe we'll see a revival of the immigrant youth who had a kind of movement before they, in a certain sense, became intimidated by the horrendous anti-immigrant propaganda that began to come from the right and the police crackdowns on immigrants that was pushed by the right. Maybe we'll see a revival of the immigrant movements in the United States, a movement against foreclosures, a movement against exorbitant interest rates on student debt, a movement against increases in tuition, a movement against public sector cutbacks, a movement against and this is really going to be ferocious, a movement against the right-wing drive, the new drive to destroy public sector unions, because private sector unions have already been they've already been reduced and intimidated in the United States. The public sector work unions are the main base of unionism now, and the fiscal crisis, the financial crisis, the shortfall in government revenues due to a crisis created by the banks, that shortfall has become the occasion for vicious campaigns against public sector workers, against their wages, against their pensions, and that's going to be very heated in the next few months in the United States.
And then what about the Republican Congress wanting to foreclose any funding now to NPR and PBS?
Yes, right. So that nobody will be able to understand anything that happens.
No, everyone will be totally confused. I've just found an article today, Frances Fox Piven, in Common Dreams, written by Joseph Huff Hannon and Andy Birchbaum, about the Chamber of Commerce. And the Chamber of Commerce, they say you would think that they just work on ordinary things and people's business and the like and the like. But they're a huge force in opposing healthcare reform, employee free choice, labour legislation, veterans' rights, banking regulations and transparency. And they have employed a firm so that they, let's see what the name of this firm is, which watches people like us and does really dirty tricks. It creates, a false document, perhaps highlighting periodical financial information, and monitor to see if US Chamber Watch acquires it. They create a fake insider persona and generate communications. A labor group the firm theorized might be allied to Chamber Watch. Maybe they'd even create two fake insider personas, one using as leverage to discredit the other while confirming the legitimacy of the second. And they're working on the dirty tricks that come straight out of the playbook of COINTELPRO, the FBI's notorious 1960s program. And they've hired this firm, and I just can't find the name of it at the moment, to get into, it's called Hutton and Williams, is retained by the chamber. It seems to me like these people could be behind Glenn Beck. And, I mean, who orchestrates his information? Where does he get the stuff about you? Who's mobilizing this stuff? Who's sort of brainwashing Glenn Beck and his sort of low IQ, semi-ignorance?
Well, I have read about the chamber. I read about it on the internet, too, on a blog by Brad Friedman.
Yeah.
So it's a different blog than yours.
Yeah.
And in the blog that I read, it argued that the chamber was using strategies developed by the FBI and the Defense Department.
Right.
And it was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And also very alarming. However, I think for Glenn Beck, the chamber is acting like a sort of political party for business lobbyists. They are not the exclusively a propaganda operation the way Glenn Beck is. Glenn Beck just has a mouth, and he has to know what to use the mouth for. He happens to have gotten the story about me and Richard, the story about our article as the plan for taking down capitalism from a small group of people who moved from the left to the right around 1970.
Yeah, now who were those people? Would you like to name them, Francis?
Sure. David Horowitz, who had been an editor of Ramparts in the 1960s and moved to the right in the 1970s. He was involved in operations like Campus Watch, in which right-wing Zionists were calling on students to watch their professors so they didn't say anything against Israel, for example. Another one was Fred Siegel, who had been a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and then moved later, I think in about the 1980s. He moved into the Manhattan Institute, which was a right-wing think tank, and became an advisor of Rudolph Giuliani, who became the mayor of New York. The Jim Sleeper, who had been on the board of Dissent magazine, is another one who is they're sort of informants. They've been on the left, so they know what's really happening. They don't know a damn thing. And then they go over to the right, and their stories sell very well on the right. It makes them important.
Why do they do it, though, when they have, and I don't like this left and right sort of nomenclature, but for want of a better term, why do they know so much and then suddenly sell their souls?
Well, you know, the weather is better, the pay is better. And also, they're bitter. They're embittered by the fact that, especially by the race conflicts inside the Democratic Party in the late 1960s, early 70s. Everything was going along. This would be a sort of American social democratic view. Everything was going along so swimmingly. We had a majority Democratic Party, And then blacks rose up, made demands, with the consequence that the white South left the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And that's all
the
fault.
The blue dogs. Yep.
Yeah, that's all the fault of outside agitators like me, for example. I mean, this is very unreal.
It's so paranoid, isn't it?
It's
paranoid. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you trained at the University of Chicago, and that's from where Leo Strauss and his colleagues emanated, who propounded, you know, free enterprise and capitalism for all the countries in the world. Would you like to say a little bit about that, Francis?
Well, Milton Friedman is the even more famous University of Chicago person who actually did try to sell free markets everywhere in the world, including in Chile.
And Argentina.
After Allende was killed.
Yep.
And Pinochet, the military dictator, took power. The Friedman acolytes went down there to advise Pinochet on how to establish markets. The Leo Strauss acolytes were more philosophical than practical, although they did have a very big influence on the neocons, who in turn became important contributors to the changing American right, and the growing American right, and were very close allies of both Reagan and George W. Bush.
So,
I come from the University of Chicago, but, you know, University of Chicago had many parts to it.
Yeah.
I went there as a 15-year-old, and I went to a college that had been designed by Robert Hutchins, who was whatever else he was. He was certainly not a neocon or an extreme right winger. And when I finished college, I entered an interdisciplinary program in social and economic planning that had been started by Rexford Tugwell, who had been part of the New Deal. So there are parts of the University of Chicago that also belong on the broad left, or belonged on the broad left of American society. And, you know, I think you probably would agree with this, Helen, that the universities in general in the United States are a place where more social democratic and democratic ideas are, in a sense, protected, that the great sweep of the country toward the right did not really take over the universities. I don't think so.
Some parts of universities,
but in general, universities are bigger than ever. They more people are in universities than are in manufacturing.
Oh, excellent. That's excellent. I'm interviewing Francis Fox Piven, the Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Political Science at the Graduate School, City University of New York. So, Francis, I want you to give, as this program is also aired in Australia as well as the US and Canada, your take on Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I don't know that I have a distinctive take on Rupert Murdoch. He is a media megalomaniac. He has very aggressively tried to take over as many media outlets as he could. He has an enormous fortune to back him up, and he has very conservative views. I don't know the details of his relations with other very aggressive right-wing businessmen, such as Richard Mellon Scaife or the Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers, they're scary.
Very important in the Tea Party.
Yeah, they're funding the Tea Party.
But, you know, we have a situation here in the United States where we have a right that is composed, importantly, of very aggressive and very right-wing business leaders and banking leaders. I include in in business leaders, banking leaders.
Yeah.
And is and that clique is partnered with a very planful effort to build a mass movement of extreme right-wing discontented people. And that's what the Tea Party represents. We've seen this before in the world. It certainly has occurred in Europe in the 1930s. And it's very dangerous. It could succeed. But I don't think it will.
The scary thing is that, you know, Hitler didn't have nuclear weapons. And if the right wing and the Tea Party is gain control of the United States, they've got about 9,000 nuclear weapons at hand, about 2,000 of which are on hair trigger alert to be launched within a 3-minute decision time by the president. So I think Sarah Palin's had her time is over, but if you look at the United States from the outside, as one does, it makes my skin shrivel.
It's very scary.
I'm not really sure where it's going. You talked about those 17,000 students at the University of Wisconsin, and of course Wisconsin's always been a very, very progressive state. But oh my God, it's sort of once you. There was a wonderful historian, and I just Lasswell, who said, when the powers that be lose the chains of iron, beware the chains of silver. And that is what is happening, I think, that the very rich manipulate through propaganda and control society, right?
Well, they're trying.
And that's what Goebbels did. Every time Hitler invaded a place, he'd take over the women's magazines and the radio, and he knew how important the media was. You know, when you talk about the bankers, I read an interesting article too, I don't know if it was the Times the other day, that talked about Madoff, and that the real criminals in this whole scandal are the bankers who now, you know, who brought down the American society through the global financial crisis, and indeed much of the world, who now are making huge profits again, and no one's brought them to heel. And this really isn't being discussed.
No, it isn't being discussed anymore. Although there are some investigations going on, and I thought it was very interesting that Bernie Madoff, sitting in jail for God knows how long, is beginning to talk about the bankers with whom he worked.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Somebody's got to squeal.
Well, he could spill the beans on a lot of them, actually, I think. Well, on many of them, anyway. Yeah, it's such an interesting time in history. And although America may be declining economically, well, it is, compared to China and India and other countries, still, militarily, it's the most powerful nation on earth, and that's what scares the bejesus out of me. I can't separate that. And, you know, until we get rid of those nuclear weapons, you know, life is very insecure on the planet, I'm afraid.
Well, yes, it is, and it's also insecure because of climate change. The right has been very adamant, and I think pretty successful in arguing that climate change was a bunch of baloney spouted by half-baked scientists, and none of it is true.
See, I don't believe in freedom of speech when it comes to science and medicine. I mean, if I lied about medicine, I would be deregistered as a doctor because I'd be killing my patients. These people are lying about science involving the future of the planet, and they're helping to kill the planet. I mean, there's no doubt about this from the scientific data. And yet, you know, I've appealed to the powers that be in the United States about how these people should be censored, but there's no law to do it, and that they're free to do what to lie however they want. What's your comment on that, Francis?
Well, I think that Well, here's the problem. that, you know, scientists don't know things with absolute certainty.
No, we never do.
Not even their opinions about climate change are, in a sense, hypotheses. They're best guesses. The best guesses that we have.
Yeah, they're prognostications.
And so we can't close off the possibility of their being challenged. We want them to be challenged. But I do think that the challenges should go forward in forums that are, in a sense, monitored by scientists.
Yeah.
Or monitored by philosophers.
Yeah.
Who at least understand the process of scientific investigation.
Well, it's like, you know, every week in hospitals we have what's called grand rounds, and we bring together all the doctors working in that hospital, and we present a patient, and we discuss the prognosis and the etiology or cause of the disease, and did we do the right thing? Were our, you know, our guesses accurate or not accurate? And that's how we learn in credible forums. And I totally agree with you that, but we've had those sort of forums. But when Glenn Beck gets on his high horse, or Rush Limbaugh, or others just spouting pure lies and propaganda in a paranoid fashion, it's terribly dangerous. I mean, in the
past, it's terribly dangerous because people, I mean, the world is very complicated.
Yeah.
Everything that people are, in a sense, called on to try to understand as democratic participants in our society,
yeah,
it's so hard to understand. It's hard even for academics to understand. So they become susceptible to the storytelling, which is lunatic stories.
Lunatic stories, yeah.
Lunatic stories, paranoid stories.
Not even fairy tales, really paranoid stuff.
Yeah. It's very dangerous.
And
it's
the other,
very,
yeah.
I don't think there's a simple solution to this. At least I can't think of
it. No, and the other thing that occurs to me, and I almost dare not say it in a public forum, but it's sticking out very clearly, that, you know, the racism that we talked about in the Tea Party towards Obama et al. Is reminiscent of the racism that accrued in Germany.
Yeah. By the way, Glenn Beck is also anti-Semitic.
Is he?
Yes.
What does he say?
Well, he named
Soros.
The nine most dangerous people in the world.
Yeah.
Beginning with Sigmund Freud.
Oh.
I was one of them, which, I mean, elevated my status no end. But, you know, eight of those nine people were Jews.
Oh. I hardly know what to say.
And, you know, his tirades against George Soros.
Yes.
He, very, you know, complicated kind of tirade. He accused George Soros, a Hungarian Jew,
mm-hmm,
who was 14 at the time when the Germans occupied Hungary.
Hungary, yeah.
He accused him of collaborating in the Holocaust. So he both pilloried a Jew, George Soros, and he pilloried him for collaborating in a campaign to exterminate Jews. I mean, what? I don't know what that is.
Well, has the American Jewish organizations, have they risen up against Glenn Beck?
Yes, yes. There's been some
only
of that.
Some?
With regard to George Soros, yeah. There's been some defense of Soros, but, I mean, Glenn Beck, of course, would totally deny any anti-Semitism. And a lot of the Christian right is ambiguous in that regard, because there is a segment of the Christian right that is very pro-Zionist.
Yeah.
They call themselves Zionist Christians.
Yeah.
Because they believe in the biblical prophecy that only when the Israelites occupy again the land of Israel, only then will the blessed rise up to heaven to be received, I suppose, by Jesus. And so they're very much in favor of defending the right of Israel to the uncontested right of Israel to the historical land of Palestine, whatever the borders of that land. And the irony is that according to the biblical prophecy, as I understand it, and this is definitely not my field, the Jews who are in Palestine will not rise up with the Christians because they, after all, have not been saved. They will go into limbo. So their job is to occupy the land and defend it so that the Christians can be saved.
Well, I think there are about 40 million evangelical Christians who believe in what you've just said, in Revelations and the end times and rising up to meet Jesus. And many of them actually are praying for the Holocaust to happen because it means they'll all be saved. There's just something that occurred to me, Francis, that I'm sure you have and many others have read the biographies of Murdoch. And in fact, he championed my career in 1971-72 when I led the movement against French nuclear testing in the South Pacific and we were getting a high fallout in Australia. And he wrote front page editorials quoting me, and he in fact started my career. But then in about 75, he suddenly changed. I started talking about uranium mining and how dangerous that was for the world. And I was totally blocked by the media at that time. And it was almost as if he'd had some sort of breakdown or psychological change that had affected him. And he became very conservative. When he was at Oxford or Cambridge, I think he was actually quite a socialist. He's got an interesting family history anyway, and I won't go into it. But I guess that most dynamics of politics goes back to psychological motivations within each of us. Do you want to just comment on that?
Well, I think that every story is different.
Mm.
A lot of people just follow the political fashion, and they drift sort of left, right, middle, whatever, as their associates do, the people they go to parties, some people have, psychological crises that lead them to change their political views.
Yeah.
And then there are a lot of people who just find it, you can live a better life on the right than you can on the left.
Because there's more money.
There's more money on the right than there is on the left. And instead of, being harangued and having to make do with a bunch of part-time jobs in order to do your political work, you get paid royally for working for the National Review, for example. I'm not prepared yet, at least, to categorically state that people move from right to left or left to right for one sort of reason.
No.
I think different people have different reasons.
It's heterogeneous. Well, now we've only got about 4 minutes to sum up. Would you like to give us a summary of what we've been talking about in just a very short time, maybe with a little bit of tinged with a little bit of hope, Francis, as being an eminent sociologist in the United States for many years?
Well, I'll try. I think that political developments in the United States over the last few years have been very depressing. On the one hand, we've had a kind of financial meltdown, which has affected not only our country, but has had made waves that have affected people throughout the globe. We have responded as a nation to that financial meltdown by doing what? By taking taxpayer money and bailing out the banks, bailing out a number of large corporations as well, and doing this without imposing any conditions on these financial institutions or on these corporations. Now, one of the widely agreed that one of the reasons for the meltdown is that these operators in finance were running wild. They were unchecked in their maneuverings, in their dealings.
And their gambling.
And one of the reasons they were unchecked is that they had used their political influence to push for the rollback of regulation.
Now, you've got to give us a very quick optimistic note, Frances.
Optimistic. Well, so far people have just been talking about the Tea Party movement.
Yeah.
But I think that I see signs of protests emerging, not from the Tea Partiers, who are not the people who have been hurt by all of this, but emerging from students and workers. I hear report after report just in the last 2 weeks of people gaining inspiration, I think, from the Egyptians who protested in Tahrir Square, gaining inspiration from the protesters in England, and gaining inspiration just from their own compatriots, from other students, from other workers.
Mm.
And I think that we may well see a kind of several pronged movement emerging against the banks for foreclosing on people and for squeezing students for the debts that they have incurred to go to school, a movement against the state governments, the Republican state governments that are now targeting public sector workers and public services, a movement that would bring together, although on different tracks, but nevertheless would bring together students and working people and maybe reverse the terrible path that has been taken by decision makers in the United States.
Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful optimistic note to end on, Frances Fox Piven. I thank you so much.
Thank you, Helen. I hope to speak to you more quickly than last time.
Okay, thank you, Frances, so much. Hope to see you again soon.
Hope so.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Frances Fox Piven, the Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Political Science at the Graduate School, City University of New York. I mentioned an article, which you may like to look up, in The Guardian in the UK, February the 16th, 2011, called How Big Business Subverts Democracy. It's about the US Chamber of Commerce. Very important and relevant to the discussion that we've just had. Thank you for listening today, and I welcome you again next week on this program. We need to make this program more ubiquitous. If you've got ideas, suggestions, or finance to help us move out to many hundreds of other stations to counteract Glenn Beck, Ed Al, please feel free to make suggestions at our webpage called ifyoulovethisplanet.org.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.